This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with filmmaker Jim Van Bever. Jim, great having you on.
Thanks.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilleter.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Jim. It's good to be on.
Nice to say hi to you.
Yep.
Jim, can you talk about how you got started with filmmaking and directing? Your first film was Deadbeat at Dawn.
Yeah, my first feature film. I mean, I started making films on regular 8mm when I was a kid. I started at 11 and made films throughout high school, and they would get more ambitious and longer in length. And it was a 40-minute film that I made my senior year that actually got me a scholarship to Wright State University Film School. And I studied, there for a couple of years, learned 16mm, met two guys that were studying there, Marcelo Gomez and Mike King. And, we all went and saw The Evil Dead and said, you know, if those fuckers from Michigan can pull that off, we can too. So we went for it, you know. But it was me, I dropped out, you know, third year, and I kicked it off, you know, and made sure, you know, pushed it through.
I always feel like sometimes maybe I should drop from college just to publish my novel, but I spent like an extra year and a half just to get my degree, and I'm kind of almost there. And I always feel like maybe it might be worth my time, but I always feel like
it's up to the individual. You know, you gotta, you know, look into the future and see, you know, is it going to be worth your time and money to have a degree? And is that really going to help you? Or is it having a piece of work going to help you? You know, I mean, what's your vocation? What are you doing? You know, it's everybody's own decision. For me, you know, especially Wright State, which was headed up at that time by not really filmmakers. I mean, the head of the department was more of a theorist, and he was more, he just wanted to turn all the students into good film critics, you know? And I was like, excuse me, this is called motion picture production. And so... you know, it depends on who, you know, your teachers are, just where you're at. To me, you know, I knew a degree from Wright State University was worthless compared to having, you know, completed a feature film. So
I've learned how to read and write in school. And so that's one thing I feel like I can do. But I feel like, yeah, there's some other things where it's like, you really don't need to spend like $100,000 and to go to an institution to do things what you love. So,
well, you know, unless you get lucky and it's NYU in the late 70s and Martin Scorsese is your film professor. Most of these guys are guys that, you know, wanted to make films, but ended up realizing that they, you know, couldn't do it or couldn't compete or didn't want to, and they turned to something safe, which is teaching. You know, not to knock teaching. I mean, I like teachers and, you know, friends of mine, filmmakers like Buddy Giovinazzo, he taught for years at the School of Visual Arts in New York. So, I mean, so does Roy Frumkes. You know, I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying, like, you know, my situation.
Mm-hmm. You're from Ohio,
Yeah. And
most of your films take place in Ohio. Can you talk about like some of the factors that about Ohio that influence your film? And I think Ohio is important to bring up because it was also a crucial state in the last election.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, the Midwestern area around there, Iowa, Indiana, you know, Ohio, whatever, the Midwest, has a certain ethic where just like to see things get done. And I mean, it's not really a film or art-oriented place. And so I don't know. I mean, if anything, it made you work harder to try and make something fantastical to escape, you know, the mindset. I don't know. As far as Trump's victory, you know, with Ohio, and I just think he speaks exactly to, you know, these kind of solid work ethic Midwesterners, you know, who, you know, don't have the glitz of either coast or the comfort of Washington or anything. And I mean, these are the people who, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs. The main factories, you know, and manufacturing plants have left in the last 15 years. And
what point did it really get bad with the manufacturing jobs going overseas? Was it the 90s, or did you even notice it in the 80s?
No, it was the 90s. I mean, it was after NAFTA. You know, it was Clinton's second term. And then, you know, from there on out, it slowly and then just wash, you know. And Trump's, you know, I mean, he sounded like hyperbole, you know, in some of his rallies, saying, you know, this is our last chance because, you know, we can't take another 4 years. And that's not hyperbole. I mean, he's dead right.
I remember going to a Trump rally in Westchester, and I was actually quite surprised of the crowd there. I know most of the media will often say that it's a dangerous place or some kind of...
Ridiculous.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Because when I
mean, dangerous only for the bust in out of town protesters that the Democratic you know, party hired sometimes for $1,500 a pop to cause violence. I mean, the whole shit that happened in Chicago and elsewhere, and these protests now, those are all organized George Soros money. It's the same thing as Black Lives Matter, and it's moveon.org. I mean, these people, they're not for real, and they don't even vote.
Like,
it's fucking ridiculous, and people can't see through that, and the media won't report on what they really are and what they're really doing because they're in on it. They're being, you know, puppet master controlled by people who invested heavily in the presidency of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, it's funny because everyone at the place I went to, there was like, zero protesters. Basically, all the main, like the news media, was around 50 people who didn't like Trump, but everyone else, supposedly it was like 7,000 people, all were pro Trump. And I was amazed. I was like, wow, I didn't realize how many like people like Trump. It's like people are scared to say they like Trump in the workplace, but when they go out and they gather, people become honest. And there's something really strange happening there where there's this secret community or consciousness of people in America not known before until they go to a Trump rally.
Oh, well, yeah. And, you know, and I mean, that was just, it was so evident during the campaign. I mean, Hillary would have 200-300 people show up and Trump would have 35,000. And then, you know, you look at the polls and it's like, well, Hillary's 9 points ahead. And I'm like, bullshit. That's just bullshit. And I mean, even if it's not a skewed poll, which a lot of them were, I think in a lot of cases, you know, the phone rings, the family's fucking sitting around, and, you know, somebody picks up a phone and some stranger says, who are you voting for? And Trump's got this stigma, you know, and they know they're going to vote for Trump, but they're going to tell a stranger on the fucking phone, oh, Hillary, you know, so give me a fucking break, man.
I did that with Sanders. Somebody said, are you going to vote for the primaries? Are you going to vote for Sanders? I'm like, oh, well, yeah. I went on the site. Then I voted for Trump.
Yeah, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, you know, I was really invested in this election, and I wanted Trump to run last time, to tell you the truth. I've been a big fan of his since, I don't know, about 8 years ago when I started reading his books. And, he's just an amazing man, and he really has accomplished incredible things through force of personality. And he's so smart and such a negotiator. And I always knew he's going to be so fantastic for the United States. I mean, it's not even, and we're seeing it already. Trump, or I mean, Obama was mocking him 2 months ago, about carrier air conditioners in Indiana, going, well, how's he going to get the jobs back? What's he going to do? They already left. And that's already been proven. The guys have realized who's going to be president, and they're keeping at least half of the workforce in Indiana now. And I think that's just the tip of the iceberg.
And no one in
So,
politics has been talking about this, anyone major, since like Ross Perot ran in the 90s.
Perot, unfortunately, he probably would have been a damn good president, but he didn't have the personality. He was a, unpleasant sounding, short old man, and it didn't work. Trump's a big orange giant who's, a billionaire. He's like fucking Bruce Wayne or something. I mean, he is Batman. So it works for a lot of people on a lot of different levels. But anyway, I was just going to say, as soon as he announced, I was supporting him at least the way that I can on Facebook, like anything he got in front of the cameras, and then with his rallies, I made sure to send him out to the limited amount of people that look at, my Facebook page or whatever. I wanted to make sure everybody knew where I stood.
And yeah, you're an independent filmmaker, and even then there's still going to be issues. But if you were in Hollywood, coming out publicly for Trump could be a
Oh yeah,
could
no, I
yeah.
would have been in a very, very, very small minority. I know how they think out there. And yeah, it would have just been gross. It would have been, well, that's the way it is out there with everything. I mean, they have no sense of criticism or critique. To them, something's good if it made a lot of money. Everything's based on money and so-called liberal cachet that, you're just down with all the quirks of human neurosis, and it's all cool. And that's some of the people in the Midwest don't put up with. And certainly, I had a small group of friends when I was in Hollywood, let me put it that way.
So your first featured film, Deadbeat at Dawn, that was actually filmed in Dayton, Ohio. I mean, I usually think of Dayton, Ohio as being a small city, but it does have a very a gritty urban feel that you get from a lot of films that were filmed in New York and Chicago in the 70s and 80s.
Well, we tried hard for that because we tried to make Dayton look much more menacing than it is or
Did it
was.
take place in Dayton or just film there?
Well, I said it in Dayton. It's referenced in the film, just like in My Sweet Satan and whatever. When I was there, it's like wherever I'm at, that's kind of where I make films about. I've been in Florida for a while here, and so I was trying to get a alligator film off the ground. We ended up shooting a 15-minute segment anyway, Gator Green.
The film reminds me of, watching old movies. I kind of There's this aesthetic now to like the whole VHS culture background, where your Deadbeat at Dawn is kind of like this old school violent slaughterhouse, where it's like it's almost comical in a sense. Were you actually trying to put some comedy in the film, or was this actually just a serious piece of artwork?
No, I think it's got a real comic book feel. I mean, it has a surreal, I hope a hyper surreal feel, and there's elements of comedy in there, of course. But yeah, I mean, it's just sort of absurd on its face. A gang that carries golf clubs, I mean,
A
just
YouTuber
once you stay, once you look at it. But you play it dead serious, and it works. Like what I wanted it to feel like an old American International Pictures film, you know, from Arkoff and James Nichols, you know, from the late 60s or early 70s. I wanted it to have that feel. And I think it does.
That's interesting because when I was watching the film again online, there's this YouTuber online. His name is Sign Masochist. And
it's not back up on YouTube, is it?
Yeah, it's actually – no, this guy who reviewed your film on YouTube.
Oh, okay. Because people post it up there all the time, and it just pisses off an independent filmmaker. You know, I'm like, motherfuckers. And I go after fucking Brad Pitt or somebody with some fucking money. Jesus.
They could donate to you or give you money. But Sign Masochist, he compared the movie to video games like Streets of Rage or Final Fight. But from what I hear, I don't know if you were interested in arcade fighting games, but to make that comparison.
He's obviously a big video gamer.
Mm-hmm.
So he's getting out of it what he gets out of it, you know. I mean,
that's very postmodern and strange.
You know, somebody who's 20, 15 years older than I am looks at it and goes, West Side Story. So, you know, I mean, it's like whatever, you know, or somebody my age, it goes, The Warriors, you know, and what, you know, it's a pastiche of a. Sort of a lot of those elements. I mean, you know, you take the gang genre, and it's just
there seems to be
what I could do, you know, at the time and the budget, you know. So
there seems to be also a philosophy in the film. There's this one part where the guy says, "I hate people, and people fuck with me." That seems to be deep, like misanthropic. Is there kind of a message about?
Kind of like,
people.
Have you seen Richard Wollstonecraft's Pearls Before Swine?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a punk nihilism, I would say, throughout that film. When I met Sam Raimi for the first time, he had seen Deadbeat. I was surprised, but he told me it was the first punk action film, and I said I'll take that.
That's you know, I think I kind of look at the film as a tragedy because at the end it's like he doesn't save his girlfriend, and then this weird kaleidoscope ending happens. Like it's this kind of I don't know. It just seems like it doesn't belong in there, that the ending with the credits coming in. But it's like, it's strange because it's like the movie, as you say, it's like this punk action film. But like, again, with the whole philosophy of being hating people, and it's almost sad as if the guy failed to do his mission to save, or he did get his revenge, but he goes out too.
Yeah, well, when he's fighting with his girlfriend early in the first reel, she says something like, "I don't want you out there in the street bleeding to death," or something like that. And so, of course, that's how it's going to end.
I'm more positive. I think it's going to end happy.
I gave you some foreshadowing. Come on, man.
Well, the thing with the film is, like, Hollywood films always like have to have a happy ending. With the only exception, I think, is like horror film. The horror genre is like the one exception where you can get away with a bad ending. It's almost kind of like if you're directing a Hollywood film, you're almost kind of obligated to have a happy ending.
Yeah, the studios or whoever's paying for it is certainly going to want you to do that. There was a golden age of nihilism in the early 70s where films were allowed to end on a bummer. I think everybody was just so bummed out about Vietnam and stuff. They had a cheap look at life, you know. And so you had great endings where your heroes died. Movies like Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, Vanishing Point, Who'll Stop the Rain, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's you look at films made between like 69 and 74, and it was not uncommon to have downbeat endings. And you know, I was going to see all these films. They were very seminal for me because I was a kid, you know. I was like 7, 8 years old watching some of this shit. And I thought, you know, this is great. That's right. You know, fuck happy endings. You know, you get that on TV. You go to the movies and you walk out bummed out. That's awesome.
Do you know of a Donald F. Glut?
Glute?
Yeah, Glute. Yeah,
Yeah.
like
I
that.
know of him. I've never met the man.
Yes, I first found out when I had the Empire Strikes Back novelization. I really liked it so much. Looked it up, and I like his films. I like his old school Spider-Man, Superman films, and I was just
No,
watching that.
I've seen that disc. I was a teenage filmmaker or
It's great.
whatever
Yeah, I
it
love
was
that
called.
film. Yeah, it's a great
Yeah.
collection.
Oh, you directed the Manson family? So this actually took you 10 years to make. Can you talk about like what originally got you interested in Charles Manson and the project?
Well, I think people my age, we had a real fascination with Manson, because we were of that age, very impressionable when the 1977 or 79, I can't remember which year, a TV movie of an adaptation of Vince Bugliosi's novel Helter Skelter was made for CBS, and it was a two-night event on CBS, and that just sort of it was a big deal for TV back there in the 70s. It's kind of like Roots or something, you know. It was a watershed moment for, as far as ratings and, you know, subject matter. And then I guess really, I was finishing up Deadbeat at Dawn, and then me and Mike King, the producer, cinematographer, Mike is. We were watching Geraldo Rivera had a 2-hour special on television called Murder America or some sort of thing, and the interview that he piecemealed out throughout the 2 hours that kept everybody staying with the whole program was his interview that he had just done with Charles Manson, where Manson just danced rings around Geraldo, made him look like the idiot that he is. I mean, not that I'm a fan of Charles Manson, but I mean, and I was just like, you know, this is fascinating. Charlie really is fascinating. Nobody, you know, Helter Skelter was good, but that was more about the trial. I was like, you know, maybe we should do really get into it and show what led up to the murders, you know, what was the scene like, you know, on the ranch. And once I got into the fucking research, that was the it was like stepping into a La Brea tar pit, you know. It's just I got deeper and deeper and just had to keep going, and shooting went off and on from 88 to 92, and then finally I was all shot, and then it was just like raising money to get the film developed, and then ran a Steenbeck to cut it on. I mean, that thing was cut on film, you know, finished on film. And then, like, you know, in 97, I had like a rough cut that was on a Beta SP that we had transferred it, and that showed at the Fan Asia Film Festival in Montreal in 97, and that got a big buzz. But it wasn't until I was in LA and met up with David Gregory and Carl Daft that they came in as partners. And we got the film finished the way I wanted, which was blown up to 35, and it, you know, got a theatrical, small art house theatrical run, 22 cities. But it was very satisfying to see the film after, you know, just sticking it out and holding out, because a lot of people wanted me just to finish it on DVD and just shoot it out there, and I was like, you know, this one's important. Yeah, damn it. And I think I've been proven right.
What's
Certainly the most
interesting is
successful thing I've done.
the film it released about 10 years ago, but it's able to sort of capture the feeling on that it could have been made in like the 70s or eighties.
Yeah, I think Deadbeat feels that way too, you know.
It's kind of a.
Well, Deadbeat actually was made in the 80s, but you know.
I actually had a.
It.
positive feelings from the Manson family, because I think of it more of it's not a sexploitative film, but like I look at it more as like porn with the violence. Do you think of
well,
that?
Well, sort of in the sense like where the knife becomes the penis.
Okay, well, you know, all I knew was, like, if you do the research, I mean, sex was the big draw of getting people to join up with the family. I mean, that was for the guys especially, you know, they're like, fuck yeah, we'll hang out with Charlie and bring him drugs because we get, you know, our pick of the women.
It's like everyone's having fun when they, like, stab each other, or there's some kind of getting high off of masturbating to violence, and it's
well,
strange.
That's what, you know, it became, because Charlie adroitly seized the paranoia and isolation and filling their head with you know, visions of a racial war, and he screwed them up pretty good. So yes, I think they were sort of gleeful, which I depicted. I mean, you hear the testimony and of Susan Atkins, and yeah, there's a. They all thought they were something special there for a while, you know. And I mean, even years after their conviction, they still floated around in this. Oh, we're all so much smarter than you are. And now, you know, now they're all like, oh God, I'm so sorry. Please let me out. And, you know, but so you know, it's they're. They were publicly exampled by the system. And, you know, did Leslie Van Houten get paroled, though, last year or so? I think she finally got out. You know, she actually didn't murder anybody. I mean, she stabbed. It's abuse of a corpse is what I'd give her, because she... stabbed, you know, Rosemary LaBianca in the buttocks after post-mortem. So.
Some people get really uncomfortable when it's like violence and porn together. Like, it seems to me those are like the two powerful things that makes a movie offensive or restricted or ever if it gets NC-17. But at the same
time...
You say porn, and I don't accept that. It's not pornography, what I did. I show sex, but it's not penetration. It's not, you don't hear goofy music in the background.
I love
that. Porn.
Speaking of switching it, okay. But thinking of music, I know you did work for Skinny Puppy. Are you close with them, or...?
Not so much anymore. I mean, you know, I've run into Ogre conventions or, you know, wherever sometimes. And, you know, he's awesome and still friendly, you know, with Kevin. And but, you know, I haven't done any work for him since.
And because it's like Spasmolytic Download did the whole soundtrack for your film. And it seems to me that there's that relation between Skinny Puppy really liking you and you giving them, you know, influence back. It seems to me that it works out, or am I...
It was very symbiotic artistic friendship, yeah. No, I mean, our mindsets were awesome. And, you know, it was just great meeting those guys in the early 90s and doing their music video. Spasmolytic was one of the greatest shoots of my life. I mean, you know, they treated me... with great respect, and I had a great crew, Canadian crew, working professional people. And I, you know, gave them all my storyboards and, you know, built a little miniature of what I thought the set should look like. And then I show up in Vancouver and these guys who, you know, were production designers on Flesh Gordon 2 or something had recreated my set perfectly. And, worked with a great cameraman, Danny Nowak, and yeah, in just 2 days we busted that thing out, and I'm really proud of that piece.
Too Dark Park, that album by Skinny Puppy, really goes well with some. I don't know, it just seems to me the imagery and aesthetics of Skinny Puppy, especially when they dress up in these elaborate Texas Chainsaw Massacre serial killer clothing, and there's something with the fine line between fine art and your work, and it seems to me that would your work be ever be considered fine art?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, filmmaking itself, or, you know, and filmmaking, the term has been so abused now that any sort of movie, in quotes, it's what I call movies, people make features on digital, that's not film. You know, it's don't tell me you were out filming, or, you know, you were out fucking shooting digital, you idiot. You know, and, you know, don't show me your camcorder Coppola, you know, masterpiece and tell me that you're a filmmaker. So maybe if enough of this shit keeps going on, guys who actually shoot on film will be considered fine artists. Who knows?
You're working on a feature-length horror called Gator Green. Is that the one you talked about in Florida with alligators?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yep. The script's done. We've lost two of our actors, unfortunately. The thing I think is going to exist as that 15-minute piece and as that script, and it's life in the future. It's probably going to mutate into something less political, and because it's really anti-war, and it's the effect of war on veterans, and then parlayed into a horror film. And, you know, I know which way the wind's blowing, and I respect our president-elect, and movies about crazy veterans isn't going to get financed anytime here in the next 8 years. So,
well, that's kind
I'm reshuffling my deck here, you know.
That's also kind of the thing about being, like, politically independent, is you end up, like, pissing off all sides.
Yeah, that's true, but, I'm going with the guy I believe in, the guy I voted for, the guy who says we must respect the vets. You know, and, you know,
what about a film like a Taxi Driver that deals with that theme of like the crazy veteran who's alienated by society?
Sure. No, I think it's legit. I think they deserve to, it should be a genre, but I'm just saying, I see America entering a new phase of nationalism and finally healthy respect for itself. That's way overdue. And I don't want to get in the way of that or look like a party pooper. So expect I'm shifting gears and expect whatever's coming out to be more.
Now, if you were to say you're would you say yourself as a nationalist, or is that a playful term?
I said I'm American. Nationalism is you love your nation, then yeah, sure.
But that doesn't include for instance, some of, and especially in white nationalism, there is some anti-Semitic aspect to that.
Oh, fuck all that. I have no time for bigotry of any type or supremacy of any type. We're all Americans, and as Trump's saying, it's time that we unify.
Yeah.
It's the left who specializes in putting us in boxes and saying, you're black, you're white, you know. You're gay, you're, you know, whatever. And, you know, these people then all march in their little groups and everybody acts like they're not part of the big American fabric, which they are. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, like, with the separation of feminism and, like you said, Black Lives Matter, it seems to me you can only be successful.
What's the end game? You know, what are they going for? You know?
Nobody wants to join forces. It's like nobody wants to, you know, like people are like, oh, I have a problem. I'm different. I have a problem with the system, yet the system advocates them being like this transgendered queer thing, which seems to me like a role playing act rather than of an identity. It seems to me people deliberately want to be opposite or different from then just being healthy and normal.
Sure. And instead of going, once you get your head on straight and snap out of it, they encourage. It's like, oh, here's your special bathroom. You know, that doesn't help the problem, which I think in that case is mental illness, but that's my own opinion.
So with that film, you still plan on making it? You just without the political theme, like just purely as like a horror film?
Well, I mean, I You know, throwing myself into it full bore, which I did, and I really tried to get it off the ground for the last 2 years. But I think the script's too political. I think it's, well, it's obviously too dark for anybody that I'm trying to get to fund it right now. But, I mean, in the course of making that 15-minute teaser, you know, I worked with real gators and, you know, the gator people down here and stuff, and I'm fascinated with it. And we're, you know, it's just, it's ripe subject matter, and to do it with real gators, not CGI, not some mechanical fucking prop from a Tarzan movie. You know, there's a lot to explore there. So I'm going to put it on the shelf, and actually I'm getting ready to move back up to Ohio for a little while. And I may really try and invest myself into making another action film, I think. I think I'm of that age now. I just turned 52. And at this time in a man's life, you feel like, I really want to get into tip-top shape one more time.
What do you...
So that I treat my body right, and then I can start smoking and drinking again when I'm 58. You know, or some shit like that.
What do you think about all these, like, IFC films or Wes Anderson films where it's not about action, and it's just about people in upper-class society having drama or romance comedies? It seems to me that's in every single independent upper class film where it's just, you know, it seems to be like he met like any Wes Anderson film. It seems to me those are the films are, but compared to your films, are action and almost classical in a sense that you're trying to revive this old culture.
Yeah, no, I mean, I fall asleep at those films. I mean, I understand why they exist, and I certainly think it's healthy for that genre to be there. And God knows, you know, I love that kind of stuff myself, if it's not done by Wes Anderson. I don't know. You know, I like Woody Allen films, Robert Altman films. You know,
do you know of shit like... Do you know of Greg Araki?
I know of him. I've never met him.
Oh, yeah. He, you know, the Doom Generation and some of... I remember really liking his films when I was like really young. And I don't know. I just like the... There's that punk aesthetic in his films. But he does flirt with the whole queer gay identity thing. But it's like, once again, it's like kind of a pulp in that 90s, 80s era, you know? It's funny because I feel like that's an extension of...
What's an extension of what?
No, I just find it like if Araki was into the whole, you know, queer underground and like of punk culture, it seems to me that his film, especially for, you know, mainstream audiences, he takes that to, you know, and consumerifies, you know, for a consumer audience, or at least flirts with some kind of... you know, he doesn't, you know, and that's what makes him have a following, is that seems Araki is, you know, talking about things such as, you know, hardcore punks and their freedom and some flirtation with that. We always bring this up, but with the same one, we're talking about Larry Clark's film Kids, or Ken Park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, wish these guys all the success in the world. It's good to have fresh, untainted voices out there, you know, and these guys are obviously trying to, they've got some sort of an agenda. And I mean, you know, that's the thing I miss about the art house culture. I mean, you know, through the 90s and early 2000s, I mean, art houses were still around in America, art house cinemas. You know, there was one in every medium and big town. And that's where you would see the Araki films or the Larry Clark films or John Waters or John Sayles or Jim Jarmusch or Linklater. You know, and I mean, that whole culture is gone. Nobody makes films for medium-sized budget. What Hollywood calls medium-sized budgets, you know, 2 to 8 million.
So, and if you want to see like an independent
platform,
Yeah,
I would like to see a rebirth of that, of, you know, good independent filmmakers actually having a market to show their stuff at, you know. I mean, because that's between fucking the internet and torrent sites and just, oh, man, the marketplace is in a horrible place, you know, if you want to try and make any money.
It seems like,
I mean,
the internet.
John Waters hasn't made a film in fucking years, right? Or Cronenberg. Or, well, Cronenberg does. But Lynch, you know, well, he got a deal with the stars on Twin Peaks. But, I mean, so many guys, they've been sitting around because it's really hard to get financing, independent financing anymore. And, I mean, this is another reason why I was like, go Trump. Because, I mean, he will make America wealthy again. And that's what independent filmmakers who go to people and ask for fucking money to make their films, that's what I need. I need people to be wealthy again, damn it.
It seems like all of these films we mentioned, maybe most of the directors, unfortunately, might be, you know, Hillary supporters or maybe some kind of liberal, and therefore everything should be free. And with the access to the internet, you can get anything free from torrent sites and downloads.
Yeah, I fucking hate that. It killed the music industry, too.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, so it's like ideology suits also the market. And if people, I guess, if there were more Trump, you know, there would be the game of working class, fang a business and all that respected rights. But it seems, so as long as you have freedom, like, you know, these weird art house films where they can do whatever they want, it seems that falls with ideology. And then they say, oh, who cares about working? Everything should be free and for the people. And then it ends up being like self-destructive.
Yeah, it sure has. I knew it was going to fall of its own weight. Yeah, I think it has. I think, America's really turned a corner. Get ready, guys, because what Trump's going to do is going to be amazing.
Oh, yes. I actually hope so.
You've done a lot of horror films. Do you have any, like, specific horror films that are your favorite or horror directors that have influenced you?
Oh, well, being an independent, I sure love George A. Romero, from, you know, what he represents as an independent and just how masterful a filmmaker and writer he is. Cronenberg was great until about, I guess it started with Naked Lunch and then Butterfly, and then he just went off the fucking rails. But his early stuff was killer. I mean, Dead Ringers is fucking awesome. The Fly remake. Carpenter's The Thing is great.
What about Existence or something with Jude Law?
Yeah, that was weak.
Yeah, I always say that too.
It was kind of like a Videodrome rehash light sort of thing. I thought it was terrible.
I saw the trailer of that with my friend, and we didn't even know it was Cronenberg. Like, this is the most strangest film ever. And it's I don't know. That film is controversial. But yeah, I do think it is one of his weakest films.
Yeah, you had a horror crime film called My Sweet Satan, and it's about a group of like bored drug addicted teenagers who get involved in like a satanic occult.
Yeah, I made that.
You talk about the like production of that and the plot, and like what gave you the kind of inspiration of it.
Well, it's based on a real murder case. This teenager, Ricky Casso, from Northport, New York, murdered this kid, Gary Lars, and with his friend Jimmy Toriano, but I mean, Ricky's the one who did the business. But it's
and you actually acted in this as Ricky.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. What I did was updated from the case happened in the early '80s. And I made it in the early 90s, and I was taking a break from Manson, which was going on forever, and we were stalling out in our fundraising. And so I wanted to make something short that would just wow investors instead of showing them all these half-cut-together scenes, just a complete piece. And so I raised, I don't know, what was 6 grand or something. And we made that in like no time. Nobody got paid, but it was just, it was pure, we're getting to make something from stem to stern, from start to finish without years of waiting, And so, yeah, I threw myself into it. And like I said, the kids around Dayton were doing, all of a sudden tattoos were the norm, and they were all into heroin and piercing and, crazy haircuts. And I said, well, I'm going to represent this. And I was 28 at the time, and I knew it was the last time I could play off or pull off playing young, so I just went for it.
And you also worked on a horror film, American Guinea Pig, A Bouquet of Guts and Gore. And this came out a
I
few years
shot
ago.
it. Yeah, I shot it.
So this is about a two women who were abducted and brought into this like hellish nightmare. I haven't seen it, but does it take place like in another dimension or in this?
No, it's like what you're watching is almost like raw snuff film. I mean, that was the vibe. Stephen Biro, the director writer, just wanted it to be look like raw snuff, and I convinced him to shoot on film, and I shot it. I mean, he had another camera going at VHS that's intercut with the film. I think that's a terrible editorial idea, but it's his movie. So yeah, it's just a gritty. There's no plot. I mean, it's just snuff. It's just these two women get shot up with a drug, so they're immobilized but awake, and they get ripped apart on screen. I mean, the star of the show is these special effects. And then I just went for a look that I took from Roger Walkins, his last house on Dead End Street, that gritty, just blacks. A void in the background while they cut up that woman on that table, and that scene was just in my brain when I shot it, and I think it definitely puts you in mind of that. But anyway, Steven's a good guy. He's often driving to Los Angeles to make his fortune right now.
Speaking of which, there was a documentary about you, Diary of a Deadbeat, and that was kind of your film about you. And from what I watched from the trailer, I haven't seen it. It seems to me that there, you definitely have a huge following, or that there is some kind of cult aesthetic to your work. And how do you tr like if somebody was to cross the street and they would say, "Oh, I know who you are. Can I have your autograph?" Would you ha do you like your fans?
Sure, I appreciate them. Of course, I do. I don't go out of my way to seek them out. I'm not. My idea of torture is like going to a convention and sitting behind a table and taking people's money for a picture or something. I mean, that just drives me ape shit. But I've done it now and then. I mean, you gotta touch base with the people who like your work. And I certainly am appreciative of that. I have no
Are the people
trouble signing autographs. It's just strikes me odd sometimes,
Do the people that like your work, are they like weirdos or disturbed criminals? And what are No, have you met them before?
don't
Okay.
know. I mean, not on the whole, let me say that. Most of them are very nice. Well-adjusted people with regular jobs who just like crazy movies. Now, of course, given the subject matter, you are gonna, if you cross this country from north to south and east to west, you're gonna run into a handful of people who have totally wrong ideas about why you make the movies you make, and they seem to have a lot of mental problems. And fortunately for me, nothing has come out of it. I did have a guy after we premiered Manson in Chicago. We went to a bar, after the screening, and there was this big, huge dude, 6'7" or something, you know, I mean, just monster, staring at us and giving me the, you know, just the I'm going to kill you face. And some people went over and talked to him, and then they come back and they're like, maybe, Jim, you ought to get out of here. That guy says he's here to kill you. And I said, what the fuck? And so I went up to him and I said, hey, man, let me buy you a drink. And we went to the bar and I just started talking to him. I didn't even let him get the offensive. And I'm like, oh, blah, 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 blah. And I, you know, just with, by being easy going around him, I calmed him down. He finished his drink and he looked at me and said, I came here to kill you. But after talking to you, I'm not going to do that. You're a good guy. So how about that shit?
Yeah, that sounds
that's a true story, man.
That's,
I mean, I don't know, you know, the guy could just be saying that, you know, but whatever.
Do you have any girl fans or something, or women that love your picks?
Quite a few.
That's what I would imagine. What are they like?
Adventurous women.
Okay.
Sexy okay. Women, you know, they're not afraid to say they like, dark films, you know.
Your next film, you said you want to make an action film. Is this going to be kind of one of dealing with a lot of these really violent, dark themes, or just more of a more mainstream action film?
There's nothing about what I make that's ever mainstream. It seems somehow, you know, and so it won't be, you know. I'm ready for the studios. It's gonna probably have to be independently financed. It'll be gritty. It'll be tough. The violence and action will be like Deadbeat at Dawn. You know, basically, it's a good reason for me to quit smoking. All right, you guys, we about wrapped up.
Okay. Jim Van Beber, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Sure, my pleasure, guys.
And also, thanks, Pill Eater.
Nice talking to you, Jim. Have a good day.
Yeah, have a great night. Have a good weekend.
You too.
All right, see you guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.